The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Just checking the sound. Is that okay? A little higher? Or, how's that? It's okay? Maybe that's... So very nice to sit with you this morning. I don't tend to make it down here on Tuesdays, unless I'm giving a talk. Then I try to show up. But it's very nice to sit, you know, in the morning and have this different light, different energy, and to sit together is a special thing, so I appreciate you coming here. My name is Max Ertstein. I'm a somewhat long-time member of IMC. Going back about, first came here in 1999 when this group used to meet in Palo Alto. And so I appreciate this place and what it has offered me in my life, and so I hope for you that you get much joy and benefit out of coming here. What I thought to share a few words about this morning is the quality of mind, or the factor of mind, which is called, in Pali, the language of the Buddha, is called pasadi, which is usually translated as tranquility, or calm, you know, calm, to have a calm mind, to have a calm heart, settledness, stillness. It's probably not surprising that this might be a topic of, you know, I think many of us associate meditation with becoming calm, becoming peaceful, becoming quiet. So I just wanted to explore this a little bit, this topic a little bit. What's the role of calmness in our practice? Is the point of Dharma practice to just be calm, you know, to become calm all the time? How does tranquility and calmness relate to mindfulness? How does tranquility relate to insight? There's a teaching of the Buddha's which is called the seven factors of awakening. And these are qualities of mind, qualities of heart, that through practice, through mindfulness, get developed. So it's not like you need to particularly work on each one, although you can do that. There's various practices. Has anyone ever heard of this, the seven factors of awakening? It starts with mindfulness, which is probably not surprising. And from mindfulness, it goes to the second factor, which is investigation. And the way I think about it is that this is not a real discursive, verbal investigation, but it's more the quality of looking more closely. So if mindfulness is to look, is to see what's happening right now, you know, without changing what's happening, just to see, open the eyes and to see what's happening, open the eye of the mind and see. So investigation is maybe to look more closely, to look more carefully, to see more detail. It's one thing to know the breath is happening, you know, breathing in, breathing out. And then to investigate that might be to see the details about, you know, what is this thing called the breath? The breath is really just an idea, but there, it's an abstraction, it's an idea that's made up of sensations, or that's made up of certain, you know, vibrations or feelings. And so what is that? You're going to get closer. So investigation is kind of this moving closer to our experience. And then the third factor is usually translated as energy or effort. I like the word engagement. It's sort of like we're getting drawn in to experience in a way that, you know, we're just more fully engaged. You know, what does it feel like to be doing something you really love and involved with it and immersed in it versus holding something back? And it's sort of like, yeah, this is okay, but it's a little bit boring or a little bit, or why am I doing this? And there's this kind of distance. And so this engagement comes through the mindfulness, comes through the investigation, and now we're really close. We're really in it. We're, you know, the whole being is starting to harmonize around, you know, whether it's walking and just feeling that, or whether it's feeling the breath, or one of the very interesting things to notice is the relationship between how engaged we are and how much joy there is. And if you can kind of, you know, think about some activity that you really like doing that brings a lot of satisfaction or fulfillment or delight, something about the whole being doing something tends to bring up joy, you know, tends to bring up delight, happiness. And this is the fourth factor, is joy. And the interesting thing about this sort of Dharma joy is that it has a lot to do with not so much the contents of our experience, but how we're relating to it. So when resistance is absent, when grasping and desire is quieted down, there's a chance for this joy to arise. And then it's said that as nice as joy is, as delightful as joy can be, within joy itself is some kind of agitation. You know, and you can just explore this, the joy, you know, it's not at all to diminish joy. To say joy is a very important part of life, of the meditative path. What one of the important functions for joy in meditation is it's a sort of an inner resource, you know. If you think about the path of meditation, it's sometimes talked about as the path of letting go. It's difficult to let go when we feel inside a kind of inner sense of scarcity. But joy can when we realize that there are reservoirs, there's resources of inner joy, in a way that's this kind of abundance that can make it sometimes easier to let go of things that need to be let go of, because we're not depending on conditions to be a certain way to have joy. We're able to find joy inside. So anyway, that's one of the functions of joy. But joy is said to have a kind of excitement which has a certain agitation involved. Sometimes when joy comes up, we think about how to get more joy, or you're worried about losing the joy. If you've ever had, you know, times in meditation that are genuinely joyful, genuinely, we enjoy it, but there can also be this little voice of like, but it's, you know, how do I keep this forever? You know, something. And it said that this kind of joy can evolve or mature or transition into tranquility, into calmness. So the source, the condition for becoming calm, for becoming tranquil, is joy. And that, you know, for some of us, it's a little counterintuitive. It's like, you know, just something to notice and experience and explore. So this quality of calmness, of tranquility, I was in the meditation. I was thinking about this a little bit, and I don't know if you've ever heard of the expression "white coat hypertension." You know, this is the phenomenon that if you go to the doctor and you get your blood pressure checked, there's something about being in that situation and having it checked and being with the doctor that, right, it tends to spike your blood pressure. And so a friend was telling me that he was seeing the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, your blood pressure is sort of inching up there. And he said, well, I think it's just the nervousness of being in the doctor. And he said, well, you've been saying that for 10 years. And, and so he got one of those home devices to check. And it was high. It was a little high, even at home and even when he checked it. And I was thinking about this and recently went to the doctor. And then I thought, well, how can I was sitting in the parking lot, and I thought, can I just make myself calm? Just meditate and just relax and breathe and see if I can sort of optimize the number when I go in. And then just before I got out of the car, I got a text message that was a little bit agitating. I thought, ah! It ruined it. So sort of like, what is the relationship between calmness and tranquility and agitation? It's said that one of the qualities of the Buddha, or one of the qualities that drew people to him, was not so much necessarily his talking, his words, his ideas, although of course those must have been very powerful, but more so or more striking was his being and how his radiance of being and how he walked, how he moved through the world. And to see someone walking and moving through the world with so much stillness, so much ease, so much calm, it was kind of like, you know, people took notice of what does this person know? What has this person developed? One of my Japanese Zen teachers tells a story of how he came to meditation practice and how he found the person who would eventually be his teacher. And it turns out he was a teenager. My teacher was a teenager. And he was on a very crowded bus and in Japan, in Kyoto. And he, if you know a little bit about Japan, you know, the buses and the trains get very, very packed. So he kind of sort of pushed his way to get to the back of the bus. And a person caught his eye, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't anything particular. The person wasn't doing anything particularly unique. It was just an older man who was reading a book on the bus. But there was something about how he was, how the quality of his being, how doing this simple activity that was very striking and inspiring to Harada Roshi, my teacher. I read a little bit to you what he says in his autobiography. Okay, he said, it was early, so the buses were very crowded. I had to push through this packed crowd of people to board the bus and then move all the way to the back. As I did so, all of a sudden, I came upon someone who struck me as most unusual. He had a mysterious presence. There was something luminous about him. There he was, an old priest wearing glasses and reading a book. Yet he glowed with a type of light. In comparison, the people around him seemed so weighed down by their thoughts and cares. I stood in the aisle, a youth who didn't like Buddhism, and yet I was deeply moved by this intelligent-looking man who seemed so deep and so still and who radiated such a brightness of spirit. Why did he seem so different from everybody else on the bus? I had never met a person like this before, and I couldn't figure out what was so inspiring about him. I was so intrigued by this man and the question he was presenting to me by his whole presence. When this man got off the bus, Harada Roshi followed him. And he followed him all the way to the gates of his temple. And then he ended up becoming his disciple and practiced with him for 30 or 40 years. So that old priest turned out to be a man called Yamada Mumon Roshi, who is, some people say, is one of the greatest masters of Zen of the 20th century in Japan. You know, my teacher had no idea who he was, but there was something about him, something by his presence. Inspiring this presence. So this quality of tranquility, the other words I think of are settledness, or of a sense of something about, you know, settledness, safety. It's like, maybe this isn't such a great analogy, but I don't know if you've ever gotten on an airplane, and a big part of the psychological experience of flying is when the pilot gets on the mic, you know, and usually, there's this calm voice of experience, of maturity, hopefully, usually. This is, you know, often there's a kind of little bit of an exotic accent. I don't know if you have some British Airways or something. You know, and there's something we human beings respond to that. We're drawn to that. Calmness or a kind of grace under pressure. One of the stories that came to mind is that in the 1970s in Tassajara, which is it's a Zen center, not far from here, there was a fire that happened in the meditation hall. They were using these old buildings it was very interesting for the people who were there to say, we're supposed to be sitting and in Zen there's this instruction, don't move, right? You know, whatever happens, don't move, just stay there. And then it became quite clear that there was a smoke and there was a fire, and then, you know, some people panicked, some people screamed, some people ran. And then there were some people who were very, very calm and very, you know, that sort of pressure brought about a kind of clarity and a kind of calm. And they, I don't know if this was the right thing or not, but I think this, as the story goes, one or two of the monks were able to realize that there was enough time to save the 800-year-old Buddha from Afghanistan that was sitting on the, you know, and, you know, so it's just an interesting, and nobody was hurt, and everybody was fine, and but this kind of calmness. When we meditate, are we trying to become calm? One of the interesting things to me about this quality of mind is that, in a way, it's said to be our natural state. You know, when just as like kind of a body of water, when nothing is stirring it up, it's serene, it's calm, and in that calmness, in that stillness, it can reflect beautifully, perfectly. When the water is really agitated, you know, it doesn't reflect. So there's something about the state of calmness which is said to be a natural state, and it's only that we tend to stir it up. We tend to agitate those waters. So, you know, so maybe this suggests a way of approaching it that just as if there's a glass of water that comes out of the tap and it's cloudy, the way for it to become still, the way for it to become clear, is to simply leave it alone. You just said, you know, just we don't do anything to it. You just put it on the table. You leave it alone, and something settles, and the natural clarity comes out. And so you know, it's a question of what would it mean for ourselves, or in a period of meditation, to completely leave ourselves alone. You know, to not try to do anything, to not try to get anything, to not try to get away from anything. It's to leave our experience completely as it is, to be here, to be present, but to be still, not to move, not to stir it up. And one of the things is we start to see how difficult that can be. You know, it's very, very difficult to do nothing. One of my teachers makes an analogy of when we look at ourselves in the mirror. And you know, you think a mirror is sort of an objective, you know, it's just there, right? But there's often, for some of us anyway, there's a certain way that we're used to seeing ourselves, or that we're used to. And when we look at ourselves in the mirror, we make a little bit of an adjustment, you know, just a little, you know, well, this way isn't quite, that's not really me, you know, just turn a little bit this way, or you kind of fix your hair or your thing or whatever, you kind of, we're touching things up. We're, you know, that's just a habit, you know, this is what we do. And so in meditation as well, there is an incredible momentum of mind to touch things up, to make something a little bit better, or a little bit this, or a little bit that, or and so there's something radical in this proposition, in this instruction, to completely leave ourselves alone. And it takes a lot of trust, a lot of patience, a lot of just to notice every movement of mind towards fixing, towards adjusting, towards improving, and just letting it go and coming back to, oh yeah, there's this and this and this. And so that in a way may be one approach to calming, to settling the agitation. Because in in the Dharma way of thinking about things, agitation itself is something we do. You know, it's like Gill sometimes talks about the effort it takes to keep a fist clenched. You know, there's a certain amount of, you know, you could make that contraction, but there's a certain amount of muscle and energy that's required. And at a certain point, the tendency, you know, is just, it will relax. And then we have to remember, oh yeah, and then you retighten it again. You know, and then if you start thinking about something else, then that will relax. And then, so maybe, you know, the idea is that there's something in the being, something in our mind and body that wants to relax, that wants to open, that wants to just be. And then we have this habit to tighten it again. Oh yeah, I have to go do that thing, you know. And oh yeah, and what about calmness? And what about... And so over and over, we're contracting. And then, so this one, so leaving ourselves alone, letting everything be just as it is. Okay, maybe that can help this fist in the mind relax. Another approach is giving our mind something to do. You know, and this is sort of the approach of focusing on one thing, like the breath, or like the sensations of touching, you know, feeling the body touch, or just opening to sounds and being with that. But it's like when we're focused on one thing, just the way a puppy sometimes needs a task, when the mind is focused on one thing, it's not feeding as much the thinking and the reactivity that's causing our agitation and suffering. So the more we can be with something like the breath in this very simple way, the less thinking there is, the less clinging there is, and the less agitation there is. So some people find that once you can get a little bit of the hang of being with one object or being with the breath, a lot of ease can be generated, a lot of well-being, a lot of relaxation. Not because necessarily there's anything magical about the breath. I mean, although the breath tends to be a calming meditation object, but it might be that in being with the breath, we're not feeding the other causes of agitation. You know, something is getting starved out in a way. Does that make sense? You know, so it's like leaving ourselves alone and then something a little more active, like being with the breath or being with the sensations of the body or opening to sounds. And in a meditation period, we may go back and forth. You know, we may sit down and just feel like, it just feels like the need, the request is to do absolutely nothing and just let everything settle. And then at a certain point, that can get, sometimes for some people, can get a little spacey, or we start to just start, you know, yeah, I'm here and leaving everything alone, and then there's kind of some fantasy comes up or some memory, and we sort of start to go into that, and there's a little bit of a, and then we think, okay, maybe it would be helpful to have something a little more active, a little more energized. So we focus on the breath, or we focus on the body sensations, and that tends to give us something to do. It gives the mind something to do. So then the third approach, so there's leaving everything alone, there's being with one thing, like being with the breath and enjoying that, the kind of the unification that comes from that. And then the third approach is with the understanding that calmness and tranquility very simply is a absence of agitation, absence of stress, we start to give a certain kind of special attention or special noticing to the agitation itself. You know, so that, I mean, this is one of the principles of Dharma practice and meditation, is that it's very hard to approach these states of joy, of calm, of concentration, of peace, of equanimity. It's hard to approach them directly, say head on. You know, you just sit down and say, okay, now I'll be peaceful. You know, now I'm going to do peace. You know, this really doesn't really work. But what works amazingly well is to start to notice the obstacles to peace. What gets in the way? What takes me away from peace? What are the habits, the thought patterns, the forms of grasping or resistance or that take me away from just that simple contentment, simple ease, simple peace. So there's a way of meditating where we simply, you know, we just hear, you're content, we're present, and then we notice what takes us away? Where do we lose our ease? Where do we contract? And it's a very interesting exploration because we can start to see that there are patterns and there are sort of habits of mind and there are certain thoughts that we might think or worries or anxieties or desires or fears that come up over and over again. And so then the practice is not so much of like I'm aiming for calm no matter what, but it's like, oh, this is really interesting. Every time I sit down, at some point or another, this certain fear comes up or this certain worry or this. And without judgment, without, you know, aversion or resistance, just really getting to know, getting familiar with that. We turn the mind towards whatever it is that tends to agitate us. Recognizing the thought. Another very helpful thing is to notice where that kind of thinking is expressed in the body. So often a mental fear or a mental concern, there's a physical manifestation. Like I, recently I've been thinking about, it's not even a health problem for one of my children, but it's a potential health problem. You know, now you can do all these blood tests and do all these things and they say, okay, you're fine, but there's a potential for something serious to happen, and the risk is now it's not 1%, it's 10% or whatever. It's like, oh, okay. What can we do about it? Well, nothing. Okay. What we can do is just worry about it. And so, thank you. So it's like, noticing that coming up over and over again in my meditation, and you know, there's some fear there's some planning mind, what can we do, what can I do, what can you know, and at a certain point I'll notice it, and then I'll notice the way that there's a sort of contraction in the body, and it's like, it's almost like the shoulders might come up a little bit, you know, kind of bracing against bad news, or it's bracing, or it's kind of, you know, and it's very, very helpful to notice that. And then rather than just trying to resolve something cognitively or think it out and think it through, and or just say, oh, it'll really be okay, or it has to be okay, or even if the worst thing happens, you know, there's all kinds of ways of just to kind of go back into the body and just be with the contraction, be with the tightness, be with the clinging in the body, and let that soften and let that relax and let that, you know, in this moment, you know, things are okay in this moment. So getting familiar with the forms of agitation is really, really helpful. And that because they start to lose their power over us, the more we know it. Just like if you're driving down a street and you're really tempted to take a shortcut, what seems like it's a shortcut. You know, there's a lot of traffic this way and you're really tempted to go whatever it is, you know, go on the service road. But you've done that so many times and you know that what actually seems like it's a shortcut is a dead end. At a certain point, even you know, that temptation may come up, but you know so much in your bones, you know what? I've done that 100 times, and 100 times I've had to make a U-turn and turn around because it's a dead end. I'm not going there anymore. You know, I just a big sign, you know, dead end, you know, just keep going. You know, in the same way, these mental detours that can seem so seductive or so, you know, start to lose their power. And it's like, okay, no, that's a dead end, that's a dead end, that's a dead end. So, not feeding these, getting familiar with them, not feeding them. Just to say a few words about, in the tradition, what's said to support tranquility, support calmness. One of the biggest supports, maybe not surprisingly, is the Pali word is sila, meaning integrity or ethics, skillful conduct. And I think the way I understand this is it really goes back to this calmness and stillness being an absence of agitation. And one of the sources for many of us of agitation, once the mind has quieted and once we're in meditation, is sometimes some form of regret or, you know, over past actions. So it said there's this kind of the bliss of a blameless life, or the bliss of not having things that we are worried about, or that we regret, or that we feel shame over. And this is not to say that anyone who has any sense of regret or shame can't meditate and become still because you have this. No, not at all. But maybe the part of the path of meditation, a part of the path of coming to deeper stillness, deeper calm, deeper tranquility, is coming to terms with, you know, with who we have been and what we've done. And it may, for, you know, I know in my own practice, and at one point when I was on a meditation retreat, I just kept a list of all the people I needed to apologize to. There's so many things were in that stillness, in that quiet, so many things were coming up, like, ooh, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I said that, you know. And so there was this process that was happening of almost like bubbling up of past actions and past, not that they even necessarily were wrong or bad, but something in me thought they were, you know, and that, and there was that, you know, oh yes, I should, I, you know, so this process of making amends can sometimes be a very important part of the path to stillness, to calm. Another big part of that is forgiveness and forgiveness for oneself. And, you know, this, you know, can I forgive myself and let go of something, you know, that I've been holding on to and regretting and feeling embarrassed about? And that's a big part of the practice, is there an internal movement towards letting go? Whereas, you know, we maybe we're all doing the best that we know how. And the more we know, the more skillful we can act. So making amends, self-forgiveness. One of my teachers who tells a story of that he, in a long meditation retreat, one of the things that came up for him was regret at throwing rocks at another child in the playground, you know, 50 years ago, 30 years ago or something. And he felt so bad about this that he, after the meditation retreat, he looked up this person who he hadn't seen in all these years. And they're like, oh yeah, I remember you. And he said, you know, I just really want to apologize for this time, you know, for how I treated you or how I did. And the guy, you know, didn't even remember that. But there was something for him, for my teacher, about that was part of his process of doing. And then there are going to be, you know, that won't always be possible to make contact with a person, or the person may not even be living anymore, and who, you know. But something about that process is very, very, can be very important towards releasing some deeper agitation. I also think of the saying, show me someone with a clean conscience and I'll show you someone with a bad memory. So you know, it's not about being some kind of perfect person. I mean, but we start to notice the connection between our inner state, our inner well-being, and ethics and integrity, and that sort of that calm mind where you don't have to, you know, many of us know the stress that's involved. You know, if you tell one lie, and then you have to remember, what did I say? Well, you know, even just kind of white, you know, and then there's a certain level of stress around that, you know, rather than just the simplicity that comes with truth, with ethics, with, you know, it's beautiful. And so you're just starting to see these connections for ourselves. And my favorite teaching about ethics and about sila is that in any moment we can decide to be ethical. You know, so it's this dynamic, no matter who we are, what we did, in this moment and going forward, we can decide not to do that anymore, not to, you know. And there's so many stories of the Buddha working with, you know, the most famous person is this, I guess what we would call now is, would sort of be a serial killer, who the Angulimala, who had killed 99 people and wore their fingers around his neck. And anyway, there's a whole story about that. But he had an encounter with the Buddha that completely changed his mind and changed his heart. And he became a monk, became enlightened, traveled around teaching. And so it's a great example of that past agitation and past conduct doesn't determine the future. In a moment, we can decide to change. The other part of that story is that this person who had harmed so many people had to deal with the karmic effects. So he would go places to teach and people would attack him and, you know, throw rocks at him, and, you know, because they remembered who he was and what he had done. So, you know, there's karma doesn't go away necessarily, but something about that, you know, so ethical conduct tends to reduce agitation. Being in nature is one of the things that's said to be conducive to tranquility. Being around other people who are calm. You know, we know how we're such social beings and we're so affected by other people's minds. And so if we're around people who are very, very agitated all the time, that's going to have one It's affect us in one way. When we can be around someone who is calm, who is at ease, who has a kind of serenity, that's going to affect us in a different way. And then just to say that, you know, that stillness, that calm, that tranquility has many uses in this practice. One of the uses is that it's said that a still mind can see more clearly, you know, has more clarity. So I think Suzuki Roshi said something like, to see virtue, to see goodness, we need a calm mind. You know, to see the good in others, to appreciate, to develop a wholesome qualities, it really helps to have some calmness of mind, some stability. So it helps us to see more clearly. And just the experience of tranquility itself can be very nourishing, can be very it has a certain kind of joy and well-being associated with it. So well-being generates tranquility, and tranquility generates well-being. It's like this beautiful cycle. So it's not like we can expect to be tranquil all the time. This is just like everything. It's impermanent. It will come and it will go. But to have some skill with in cultivating that state in some periods of the day, of the week, that we can cultivate tranquility. It can affect our life in so many ways, so many positive ways. Maybe that's enough to this about tranquility, calmness. We have a few minutes. I don't know if anyone has a question or...